Hello, everybody. Happy to spend my evening with you. So, practice as a path of inner healing. It's not a way that one typically hears the Dharma framed, although I should mention that in the Buddha's time, the Buddha was sometimes referred to as the great physician or the great healer, because he helped humans to heal from the great human disease of suffering. Still, I'm not sure that I'm quite using it in that sense, but it's a little related. But the reason I am using it in the sense that I am is because I think the language that was used in the Buddha's time and that is still used today to describe the fruits of the practice is awakening, liberation, freedom. And I think that a lot of people who come to the practice don't really relate to those words. They're not really sure what it means or if it means something to them. But I think it's not unusual at all for people to come to the practice out of a sense of some kind of woundedness, fragmentation, separation, and a sense of wanting greater wholeness. Which is really what healing is. It comes from the Latin root of to make whole. So, as I'm using the word, it's, you know, healing is an inner healing, so it's not about a bodily healing. And it's not, you know, in terms of the healing of the psyche, it's not about creating a new you. It's not self-improvement or a fix-it kind of thing. It's usually about something that is been kept outside of the heart, that it's been met with aversion in the past, and then finally allowed in. In that way, it's an inner discovery or recovery. You know, Vivek Murthy is our National Surgeon General. And for those of you who do not know, he is a really cool guy. I heard a long interview with him a few months ago in a podcast. Krista Tippett interviewed him. And some of the things that I learned about him just blew my mind. That here he is, the Surgeon General, and he has pointed to loneliness as one of the greatest public health problems happening today. And so one of the most important public health initiatives he has is to combat social isolation. He also knows what meditation is, sort of in our terms, not just stress reduction, if I can get away with saying that here. And he takes it really seriously as something that he wants to and is trying to spread around to as many Americans as possible. But that's a tangent. Back to what I was saying, but what he said about healing, just so you know who he is, he said he agreed that it was about wholeness. And he said to truly feel whole is not about acquiring something we don't have. It's about remembering who we fundamentally are. Remembering who we fundamentally are. So my own feelings of brokenness began really early on. As a child, I experienced profound unhappiness from a young age. And then later, in my mid-teens, I became physically disabled. And this was, I didn't know at the time, but I had been become disabled from a disease that wouldn't be diagnosed for a very long time. So this situation just added so many new losses and new wounds, so many inner and outer complications on top of the ones I had going on. I'm sure you can all understand that none of this helped my mood at all. Fortunately, though, there were actually some healing elements in my teenage years. There were some caring individuals, and there was exposure to compelling new perspectives in life, on life in general, and on the inner life in particular, especially through art and creativity. Then, when I was 21 and living in Western Massachusetts, I heard about IMS, the Insight Meditation Society, and I started going on retreats. A couple of years later, I moved to Boston for a new job, and it did not take me long to find CIMC. So I had a daily life meditation center and a retreat center all in this very small state of Massachusetts, and it felt like a really tremendous and rare blessing to me. I sat a lot. And I did this despite the fact that in the beginning, to be really frank, it was often torture. I mean, it was very difficult because, I mean, I told you that I'd been unhappy for most of my entire life. It's not like that just disappeared. I had to sit with that. I had to sit with all the distress, all the torment. But I just knew I was in the right place. There was something about the Dharma that touched me so deeply. So there was this long beginning phase where I was often sitting with difficulty. But I was also learning to attend to what my experience actually was. You know, rather than the stories in my mind of what I thought about it or what so and so thought about it. I was starting to be able to recognize and acknowledge and occasionally even befriend body sensations, thoughts, emotions, whatever arose in my field of consciousness. A moment of acknowledgement here and there. It started to build. I got to know the energy and texture of these arisings, their tendencies to wax and wane. And at some point over the years, I gradually noticed that there was something had shifted or was shifting. I didn't know what to call it. I wouldn't have called it healing then. But I was feeling happier. Maybe it was like the ratio of wholesome to unwholesome mind states or happy to unhappy mind states was shifting a little bit. I think there was still plenty of difficulty, but I wasn't quite as lost in it. There was now some space around it. And also, there was room for other things, that it was starting to be that my entire experience wasn't just difficult. I mean, my entire experience never was just difficult, but I didn't notice that until I started practicing. Anyway, that process, that shift that I started to notice after a while kept on going, kept on going, kept deepening over the years. And now it's been almost 40 years. So it really builds on itself. And I was hesitant to say anything about my own healing process or to give any specifics because my sense is that if anyone really sticks with Dharma practice for a while, it's healing for many, 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 many people. This is not unusual. But I would, and I don't have, it's not like I've done a survey. I don't know for sure how many people have these experiences and, what they are, but my, somewhat maybe informed in assumption, but it is an assumption, is that everyone's healing is unique and individual. And I don't want anyone to start thinking that it has to look the way mine does. Oh, well, what's happened to Rhea isn't happening for me. Well, no, of course it isn't. Your healing is going to look totally different. So rather than go on at any more length about myself, I thought I'd just mention some of the parts of a healing experience that my strong hunch is that they are the universal parts. And one is that it's totally not a straight line. There's not ever an end point. I'm reminded of, I really don't know when this was exactly. IMS had a 25th or 30th reunion, not reunion, anniversary celebration. I think it was one of those that I went to it, and they didn't advertise that Ram Dass was going to be a guest speaker because they wanted people to come out of a love for IMS, not because Ram Dass was this great celebrity. So Ram Dass was there, and the only part of his speech that I remember was he had decades of practice behind him, and he inspired so many people. And he said, "In all this time, I haven't gotten rid of one single neurosis." The audience cracked up, but of course, he was dead serious. And I think that really is a universal thing of it. It's not about, as I said before, becoming a new, improved you. And it's mostly a mysterious process, not something that any of us control. Recently I told a Dharma friend of mine the title of this talk, and she told me a healing experience that she had. So she's somebody who has also been practicing for somewhere between 30 and 40 years. And she had a really difficult childhood and described herself as feeling like she came out of that childhood like damaged goods. And because of that, she never expected that certain fruits of the practice were ones that she would experience. For example, she never thought she would really know what true compassion felt like. She just thought that part of her heart had been hurt too badly. And then there came a point, for no apparent reason, much to her surprise, she wasn't doing the formal compassion practice, but she started to feel a flicker of compassion. It just arose. And she said then, over the next years, it just kept growing, gradually, slowly, but surely. And now she experiences real, full compassion. So it's mysterious and often spontaneous. And it's not something you order off a menu. It's like maybe she wanted the emptiness fruit, but she got the compassion fruit. So it's organic and unplanned. But each of us does something to influence the process. We are crucial to it. So recently I've been using a metaphor to help me compare the role of my effort. Could be yours too, in the contemplative healing process, with the role of those mysterious forces I've been referring to. What do I do? What do the mysterious forces do? And I've started to compare my role to a garden. The garden is a natural ecosystem, or it's an ecosystem. But it's a cultivated one. It's not like a prairie or a field that's just out in nature. It's not a forest. A garden is specifically something that a human being decides, I want to plant perennials here and vegetables there. There's an idea behind it. And gardens are among my favorite things. So, in the days when I was gardening a little bit more functionally, now I'm mostly just corralling helpers rather than doing it myself. But I learned a lot in the days when I had a little bit more ability. And my job in the garden was, I would pick out an appropriate spot for the kinds of plants that I wanted to grow. Vegetables have to have a lot of sun. But if I wanted a shade garden with ferns or perennials or trees or whatever, that's a whole different thing. The right plant has to be in the right place. I have to make sure that the soil is got enough nutrients in it. I have to water the garden, or make sure that somehow the plants get watered. There might be a few more things that I would do, but after that, it's really just nature takes its course. The soil and the wind don't sit down with pollinators, flora and fauna, and predators to discuss a plan about how to get this garden to grow, or if they're going to allow the garden to grow. It's nonverbal innate abilities of nature that take over somehow. So, this past summer, I was reading the news, and I love to go to like the gardening section in the newspaper. And this one was a really silly puff piece, but the comments in response to this piece were wonderful. And one of them said this: "Gardening is not a competition with nature. It's finding a balance with it and realizing you are very much the minor partner in the scheme of things." You are very much the minor partner in the scheme of things. So, onto the human side of this. or more about the human side. So, for this metaphor, and really, actually, this is how I look at humans. I look at each individual mind-body process as being its own ecosystem. But usually I don't get as specific as I'm about to tonight, which is just to promote the just to continue the metaphor and go on with the talk. And so when a human ecosystem is practicing meditation, I'll speak for myself. When me as a human ecosystem practices meditation, my job, as I see it, is to learn the basics and then, tailor the basics to the conditions and conditioning that I'm personally working with in my life. So, what I mean by that is there are some basics that maybe many, many people will do similarly or will be taught similarly, but then we each have to adapt them to our own hearts and minds, our own life situations. And then things like, what specific technique might I learn? What meditation program, workshop, retreat, class might I do? All of that can vary widely. And then another thing is to do whatever one does to somehow make it a regular part of one's life. The keeping it going is really key at some point. Now, the Dharma is really vast, and my assumption is that every aspect, every teaching is healing. The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Paramis, the Five Spiritual Faculties, on and on and on. I can't imagine there's anything the Buddha taught that somebody couldn't explain why and how it's healing. You know what? I think I'm going to take a pause for a minute. I'm not sure which way I want to go with this, if you can just give me a minute. Okay. Sorry about that. I'm ahead of myself, really. I'm not going to continue with the every aspect of practice. So I had been talking about tailoring the practice to yourself and also making it a regular part of your life. And if you remember the quote that I wrote or read earlier, gardening is not a competition with nature, it's finding a balance with it. And realizing you're very much the minor partner in the scheme of things. Well, I revised that quote to have it applicable to practice. Practice is not a competition, with anyone or anything, least of all with nature. Rather, it's about creating the conditions that allow nature to heal you and realizing you are very much the minor partner in the scheme of things. The important thing to remember is that in nature, just as you can't force a seed to germinate or a leaf to unfurl or fruit to set, you also can't force your own mind to heal. You can't force healing to happen in any particular way at a particular time. In fact, force is a very sure way to prevent healing. So I want to touch a little bit on how a human ecosystem is different from a literal garden. One way is that each of us evolved with coping mechanisms, defenses, a shadow side, aspects of ourselves or life that have been unacceptable to us, that we don't like, that feel threatening. And usually they feel threatening or unlovable for good reason. Defense mechanisms need to be respected. It's important not to try to bust through them. In fact, I would say that defense mechanisms are part of every mind-body ecosystem, short of a Buddha's. They aren't mistakes, and we aren't bad for having them in our ecosystems. And again, you know, a harsh busting through a defense mechanism would be counterproductive, especially. Especially when there's been trauma, whether it's small T trauma or large T trauma. And at the same time that it's important not to bust through, defense mechanisms or shadow sides are types of fragmentation. They really cry out to be restored to wholeness. And by wholeness, I mean here to be brought back into the field of awareness, where they can be seen and known. If and when one is ready, there isn't a hurry. In my opinion, anyone who's begun practicing is already in a healing process, whether it feels that way or not. It's important not to force it. I had the great good fortune of being able to work with Stephen Levine when he was alive. He was a remarkable Buddhist teacher. And he said something that I'm not going to get the numbers quite right. I don't remember exactly which numbers he used, but he said something like, don't try to start with the 500-pound weights. Instead, you should start with the 10-pound weights. So I think that's great, but I've got to tell you, my vantage point, being not nearly as strong as I might look, £10 is too much to start. I mean, for me, I start with a pound, 1 pound, and I'm fine with anybody who wants to take a page from my playbook and really start light. There's no need to push yourself. Another wonderful teacher of mine was Michelle McDonald. And she said, this is not an exact quote, she said that it was important to respect your system's limits because that way it will learn to trust you. Respect your system's limits so that it will learn to trust you. So all we do is our practice. We push the edge of the envelope, but trust our limits. The rest is out of our hands. Can we let the mysterious, innate healing process simply happen on its own? Finally, since it seems to be all of a sudden that I'm calling on my teachers, I'd like to relay a wonderful talk that I remember Narayan giving. I'm sure it was in the 80s when the Dharma Hall was still on the first floor of the center where I think the dining room is now. And this was on Valentine's Day. And so Narayan began the talk with, asking people to consider times when they felt really loved. And then she said, you know, she wasn't talking about romantic love, but just when you felt really loved. And she said that she wondered how many people could relate to a time when they felt most loved as being when they had some strong feeling, you know, either something wonderful or something really hard and difficult, but something that was meaningful, important to them. And someone in their life really listened. Really listened very deeply. It was somebody in that deep listening who wasn't inserting themselves into the story, wasn't trying to say, oh, well, that happened to me too, blah, blah, blah. They weren't giving advice, but they were clearly there, maybe occasionally asking a clarifying question or two because they were really interested. And they were also calmer and steadier than we were, which was helpful because it helped us ground. And I think most everyone there could relate to it, or maybe I'm just projecting that because I know I totally related to that. And then Ryan said, okay, so now consider mindfulness and think about love. What's really the difference? With mindfulness, it's an intra-psyche process. It's something we're doing with ourselves. We're doing this deep listening, trying not to insert anything else, but to really hear it just as it is, being so allowing and accepting. Maybe showing interest and investigation and a little non-identification, staying in our center rather than getting lost in the content. So, love, mindfulness, what's really the difference? And what does this have to do with the talk on healing? Because I ask you now, would you know what I meant if I said, isn't love healing? Don't you think love is healing? You can, maybe after the talk, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to bet that most of you think, oh, yeah, love is healing. But isn't that mysterious? How does it heal? Cambridge is a smart kind of town. I'm sure a lot of people could come up with some good answers. But ultimately, do you really know? Isn't it a mystery? And isn't the mystery kind of awesome? I think I'll just leave it at that for now. I want to really thank you for your kind attention. And let's sit for just a few minutes. May all beings know their essential wholeness. Okay. May you all have the rest of your evening be lovely. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.